listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Hope and Change by Kate Anderson Brower. And the listener should remember that this article went to press long before President Biden dropped out of the presidential race. Shortly after they left the White House, the Obamas appeared in photos on some luxurious headline-grabbing trips, including a stop at billionaire Richard Branson's Necker Island in the British Virgin Islands, where Obama famously went kite surfing, a trip abroad David Geffen's yacht, and a stay on the late Marlon Brando's small private atoll near Tahiti. The Obamas have spent time with Clooney and his wife Amal at their Lake Como villa and hung out in Barcelona with Steven Spielberg before a Springsteen concert, where Michelle Obama and Kate Capshaw sang backup as Springsteen and the E Street Band performed Glory Days. Some people thought the Obamas deserved a break after 8 years of unmatched scrutiny and pressure. Others were predictably less generous. "I'm glad he's having a nice time. America is on fire," quipped HBO host John Oliver. Next photo, former President Barack Obama and George Clooney leaving Villa Oleandro on Lake Como in 2019, and Michelle Obama on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, 2022. When Trump was president and the country was becoming more and more polarized, everyone wanted him back in the fray, says Schultz. Democrats wanted a savior, Republicans wanted a foil, and members of the press wanted clicks. But the Obamas were going to wait for key moments to speak up. Rhodes, who is currently a senior advisor to Obama, recognizes the frustration on the left. "I have friends that want Obama to speak out more on whatever crazy thing Trump is doing. I actually think he has a greater megaphone when he does choose to speak out, because he's not popping off on Twitter about it and doing a bunch of interviews. He sees himself as a unifier, and he considered his main job to be bringing the party in line behind the nominee at the end of the 2020 primary. He was publicly neutral until that April, when he made a 12-minute video endorsing Biden. In that election, behind the scenes, Obama helped nudge members of his party to support Biden and had a series of conversations with Biden's progressive challenger, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Together, the Obamas, the former First Lady's reputation as the closer makes her just as valuable a campaigner as he is, proved their restrained strategy was still effective. It is, of course, easier to stay above the day-to-day political fight as a former president. Per an advisor, Obama does not read the intelligence briefings provided regularly to former presidents, except to Trump, whom Biden barred in 2021 because of his erratic behavior. Although the advisor doubts their value in the first place, do you know any former president who actually reads them? Melania Trump could not compete with Michelle Obama's popularity, even if she wanted to. Michelle Obama left the White House with a 72% favorability rating, according to the Pew Research Center. Compare that to her impenetrable successor, Melania, who left at an historically low 42% per a CNN SSRS poll. Unlike the Trumps, and even the Bushes, Michelle Obama is central to what the Obama name is building. And she's dominating on Instagram, where she has 57 million followers, and her husband has 36.3 million. I think the Clintons are co-CEOs, and the Obamas are co-stars. They're all stratospheric celebrities. Hillary's got business. She's got work. Michelle is co-star of All Things Obama. Hillary's co-CEO of All Things Clinton, says Seffel. It's equal billing in their post-presidencies. Obama-style evolution, notably the $3,900 over-the-knee Balenciaga glitter boots she wore while promoting Becoming in 2018, put a spotlight on the constraints she was under as First Lady. Remember her controversial decision to cut her bangs? Like most First Ladies, she wanted to make an impact that went beyond her fashion choices, so she self-edited. Can you imagine the reaction if she had worn those boots to a state dinner? Michelle Obama had to be the most perfect First Lady that ever was, says Jarrett. She knew that the spotlight was on her every single minute of every single day, she tells me. The younger generation was watching, and she wanted to make sure she did right by them and right by our country. And that was 8 years of a lot of pressure. This is somebody who has been an A-plus performer her entire life. The political world was really challenging for her in that way, because it's not fair and it's not based on merit. Out of the White House, she has been able to be herself. Seffel saw Obama speak in front of a massive San Francisco crowd. Few people can be so natural, so authentic, and so electric all at the same time, she says. You cannot look away from Michelle Obama. Last year, Gail King hinted at a question she already knew the answer to. Would Obama consider running for office? I am authentic, the former First Lady replied. If I were going to engage in politics, I would let people know. She has been clear that she never wants to run for president, but the right has used her to scare Republicans and independent voters, many of whom hate the idea of a black woman in the Oval Office. Look at their reaction to the idea of a President Kamala Harris. Inside the White House, the rumor was barely discussed. Everybody knows how laughable it is, an Obama advisor tells me. That's the last thing she would want. Oh, my God. Amid the Biden crisis, Michelle Obama is polling 11 percentage points ahead of Trump, well beyond any office holder whose name has been mentioned. Around the Super Bowl, Donald Trump Jr. posted a photograph to his Instagram with 7 million followers of former Pittsburgh Steelers linebacker Levon Kirkland with these words superimposed on it. I found this rare Michelle Obama rookie card. Nasty, racist, and sexist slurs have long bubbled up in conspiracy theories trumpeted by the right. Her aide tells me that it happens so often it's almost heartbreaking. While the former First Lady's office won't issue statements about conspiracy theories because they believe it only gives them oxygen, it does affect Obama on a personal level. As an aide says, she's a human being. Deisha Dyer, whom the Obamas named as their social secretary in 2015, thinks that while her former boss will be more and more real as time goes on, Michelle Obama still feels the sting of her critics. As somebody who worked for them and watched them be attacked, it doesn't hurt any less for me to see it. I have nieces and nephews growing up in a world with people like that, and it makes me angry. She's probably not over it. It could hurt a little bit less, but it's still there. We're all human. In Becoming, her blockbuster 2018 memoir, Obama notes her unique place in the American story. I carried a history with me, and it wasn't that of presidents or first ladies. I'd never related to the story of John Quincy Adams the way I did to that of Sojourner Truth. On the flight with the Obamas from Joint Base Andrews to California after Trump's inauguration, Jarrett saw Michelle crying, tears shed from sheer exhaustion and an enormous sense of relief. Like her husband, she is continuing to work on issues she cared about as First Lady. Her Let Girls Learn initiative in the White House promoted girls' education globally, and in 2018 she launched the Girls Opportunity Alliance, part of the Obama Foundation, designed to educate and empower adolescent girls around the world. Since its creation, it has raised and distributed funds to more than 130 grassroots organizations in more than 36 countries to support girls, from scholarships to leadership development programs. In 2022, Obama joined forces with two other female powerhouses and girls advocates, Melinda French Gates, who recently separated her own work from that of the foundation she once co-chaired with her ex-husband Bill, and Amal Clooney, co-founder of the Clooney Foundation for Justice, for an event in support of the Girls Opportunity Alliance's Get Her There campaign. They also announced a coordinated effort between their organizations to advance gender equality and end child marriage. Her nonpartisan initiative, When We All Vote, was created in 2018 with the goal of getting more young people and people of color to vote. In 2020, 512,000 people either started or completed the voter registration process with When We All Vote. During the midterm elections in 2022, 90,000 people registered to vote or confirmed they were registered to vote with When We All Vote, either online or at events. The former First Lady recruited celebrity A-listers as co-chairs, including Steph Curry, Jennifer Lopez, and Tom Hanks. But there is an everlasting hunger for gossip. In April 2023, Obama told Gayle King on CBS Mornings, "Marriage is hard, and a lot of young people quit on marriage over things that are just a part of the commitment. We've been married for 30 years. If I fell out with him for 10 and we had a great 20 years, I'd take those odds any time." In a May interview on the same television show, the former president opened up too, saying, "It sure helps to be out of the White House and to have a little more time with her." She was always a straight shooter about the imbalance in relationships. In 2004, when her husband was in the race for the U.S. Senate, she told the Chicago Tribune, "What I notice about men, all men, is that their order is me, my family. God is in there somewhere, but me is first. And for women, me is fourth, and that's not healthy." Michelle Norris reminded me of a 2007 Maureen Dowd New York Times column, She's Not Buttering Him Up, that criticized Michelle Obama for ways that she tried to humanize her husband during their first presidential campaign. Dowd found fault with what she said at a fundraiser in New York when she teased her husband for not putting his socks actually in the dirty clothes. "This princess of South Chicago," Dowd wrote, a formidable Princeton and Harvard Law School grad, "wants us to know that she's not polishing the pedestal." That kind of hypercriticism is why, according to Norris, she had to be superhuman when she was First Lady. Now, as a former First Lady, she bends over backward to say she's just like you. Her straight talk is not surprising to the people who know her well. She has a famously close and loyal circle of female friends who keep her grounded. They include Jarrett and Norris, whose husband, Broderick Johnson, was assistant to the president and secretary of the cabinet under President Obama. She is also close with Chicago-turned-D.C. friend Kelly Dibble and to the poet Elizabeth Alexander. "Obama talked candidly about race before she became First Lady," she told 60 Minutes in 2007 when her husband was a presidential candidate. "As a black man, you know, Barack can get shot going to the gas station." She admires the way Laura Bush approached being First Lady with quiet restraint. But that was never really who Bush was either. After nearly 8 years of hypervigilance, of watching for the next danger or tragedy that might be coming, I could at last exhale. I could simply be, the former First Lady wrote in her memoir, Spoken from the Heart, about the relief she felt leaving the White House. Obama could relate. During debt ceiling negotiations last summer, a source says, Obama and Biden commiserated about the Groundhog Day nature of the battle. Obama faced a similar crisis in 2011. The phone conversation may have also allowed Obama to check in on the octogenarian president. That day, Biden had taken an embarrassing fall when he tripped on a sandbag on stage at the Air Force Academy commencement. Biden was going to need Obama to attest to his fitness for the office. Now, more than ever, you need to strike at the right time for key surrogates to be useful, a Biden aide told me before the debate. You don't want to waste them, and a year is a lifetime in politics times five. Eric Lesser started working on Obama's 2008 campaign before he graduated from college and went on to work as a West Wing aide. But he couldn't win the Democratic nomination to be lieutenant governor of Massachusetts in 2022, even after scoring a photo op with the former president at the Obama's home in Martha's Vineyard. Still, Lesser, who served four terms in the state Senate, says he believes that the Obamas' combined star power is unmatched. George W. Bush left with his tail between his legs, with a massive economic crisis and two disastrous wars, he says. By contrast, there is an immense reservoir of goodwill for the Obamas. I was in barbershops and VFW halls and 4th of July parades across the communities I campaigned in and visited, and over a long period of time, 8 years, it was clear the admiration people have for him, and it's transcended party identification. I had Republicans who admired how he raised his family and the character and the dignity that he brought to the office. So many presidential traditions, things that aren't written in stone but have become quasi-sacred, were trashed the moment Trump stepped into the Oval Office. A fatal breach of the U.S. Capitol, two impeachments, and countless unprecedented moments later, including Trump's conviction on 34 felony charges, and the Obamas are holding firm to the idea that their brand of politics can thrive, even amid Trump's brand of red-hot fury. I'm still the hope guy, Obama has said without a trace of cynicism. On the rare occasion when Bill Clinton would stop by the Obama White House, Jeremy Bernard, who was the Obama social secretary from 2011 to 2015, remembers Clinton giving him a hug and introducing himself to his staff, who were amazed. Clinton once told Bernard that Obama wasn't good at the easy stuff, the mixing and mingling. Obama was more focused on the job and didn't know who all was in the room. They haven't changed. They have a close-knit group, Bernard says. That includes pre-presidency friends from Chicago, like Marty Nesbitt and his wife, Dr. Anita Blanchard, and D.C. pals like Dr. Sharon Malone, an OBGYN who specializes in aging and menopause, and her husband, Eric Holder, who was Attorney General in the Obama administration and the first African-American person to hold the office. Bernard was on the receiving end of complaints from high-dollar donors who wanted to know why they hadn't received more invitations to the White House. For me, President Obama is what I really want in a president. His policy and most of what he stands for are right in line with what I feel as a progressive Democrat. But being his social secretary could be an effing nightmare. Bernard sees how the escalated number of threats made life even more difficult for Obama. When I worked there, the Secret Service was so much more cautious, even when walking to the Oval, he says, and then goes on to describe a private lunch at the Trump White House hosted by Ricky Niceta, Trump's social secretary. I was supposed to go in the West Gate, and I ran into some folks from the residence, and I told them I couldn't walk in with them. But the Secret Service said, come on in. That would not have happened during the Obama years. It was more heightened security. You go through the gate you're assigned to go through. As we've seen over the past few years, political violence is a frightening reality in our country. Bernard recalls that once he was in the Rose Garden showing the First Lady different options for table decor ahead of the state dinner for German Chancellor Angela Merkel in 2011. I was walking out with her, and President Obama walked out of the Oval to come take a look, and I saw the Secret Service getting more and more concerned. The first lady said, half joking, "Barack, get back inside. Look how nervous they are." She knew they weren't prepared for him to step outside and walk into the Rose Garden. For now, the Obamas are looking toward the big picture and their legacy. They remain unflinchingly optimistic about the future long term. To many political observers, however, short-term optimism would require a hefty dose of magical thinking. On the question of whether Trump will be invited to the opening of the Obama Presidential Center, living presidents, current and former, are front and center at these things. Obama insiders just laugh and say the guest list isn't drawn up yet. But one Obama veteran recognizes the inevitability of the question. People are good at pretending the decision doesn't need to be made because there's no issue, this person says. But everyone knows that there's an elephant in the room. Setting the stage. Before they conquered Hollywood, George Segal, Peter Falk, Roy Scheider, and Wayne Rogers were some of the finest. though perhaps not the finest, stage actors in New York. Wayne Lawson, who knew them when, revisits a golden era that revolutionized American theater. Opening photos, Almost Famous, Peter Falk in TV's The Trials of O'Brien, 1965. Roy Scheider with his wife Cynthia Bebeau and John Heffernan in The Alchemist, 1964. George Siegel with Sandy Dennis in the film Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, 1966. People are surprised when I tell them Peter Falk was my roommate in New York 65 years ago. They are even more surprised when I say that Falk was not the only one in our circle of friends to attain stardom. So did George Siegel, Roy Scheider, and Wayne Rogers. What still surprises me, though, is that those four weren't necessarily the ones I assumed might become Hollywood giants. Looking back, I realize what a watershed moment in the American theater I was able to witness. Surrounded by hugely talented, wildly ambitious, and often tragically flawed individuals. Watching their old films today, I can clearly remember them in their 20s and early 30s, when they were just ordinary people, and we were all young nobodies. In the fall of 1959, I started on a PhD in English at Princeton, but after just a few weeks, I was miserable. At 27, with an MFA and 2 years of study in Paris, I had reached the point where I was sick of being a student. When I confessed this to Philip Miner, a Princeton graduate who had already directed a play off-Broadway in New York, he said, "So quit. You should be writing, not taking a bunch of courses you hate." He was alluding to the one-act play contest at Princeton, which I had won 3 years in a row. The last play, Reflections, had been published in the Hudson Review, and Ben Piazza, who as a junior had played the role of Narcissus in it, had since become a member of the Actors Studio, the high temple of method acting, and starred in 2 Broadway plays, Winesburg, Ohio, opposite the movie star Dorothy McGuire, and Kitake with the Japanese actor Sessue Hayakawa. When I went to see him in the latter, his first Hollywood movie, The Hanging Tree, with Gary Cooper, had just been released, and he told me Lee Strasberg, the revered guru of the Actors Studio, had predicted that he could be the next John Garfield. "Quit," Miner continued, "and come to New York. You can stay at the Mission until you get a job." That was the joke name for the top-floor walk-up apartment he shared with 3 other actors on 14th Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenues. That was all it took, plus the fact that 2 Princeton classmates were also in New York, Chiz Schultz, who was a producer at CBS, and Ron Harper, who was on Broadway in Tennessee Williams' Sweet Bird of Youth, understudying Paul Newman. A week later, I informed the stunned dean's office that I wished to withdraw, and a week after that, I moved to 212 East 14th Street, where my roommates were Miner, Rogers, Falk, and James Carruthers. I already knew Rogers, a Princeton classmate. He had been in the Triangle Club, to which I contributed a brief skit our senior year. After serving in the Navy, he had studied acting at the Neighborhood Playhouse in New York and got some bit parts on TV. Up to then, he was Bill Rogers, but since there was already a William Rogers in Actors Equity, he had to change his name. A group of our friends decided that my name went best with Rogers. In 1959, he was enjoying his biggest success up to then. A brief appearance in a bar scene in Odds Against Tomorrow, a film noir starring Hera Belafonte and Robert Ryan. Through friends, I also knew Carruthers slightly. He was 28 and studied with Uta Hagen and her husband at the Herbert Berghoff Studio. He had recently replaced the juvenile lead in the off-Broadway production of Thornton Wilder's Our Town, directed by the hot young director Jose Quintero. Falk, who was 32, had been a cook in the Merchant Marine and earned an M.A. in public administration at Syracuse University before studying acting with Eva Le Guyen. In 1956, He had arrived at a casting call for a revival of Eugene O'Neill's The Iceman Cometh. Quintero, in his memoir, If You Don't Dance, They Beat You, describes the moment. What have you done recently? In the theater, I mean. I was in a play with Miss Eva Le Gallien in Westport. He raised his arms, placing his elbows on my desk, and opened his hands. And that is all, he said. I thought, this guy is the greatest con man ever. I liked him, and I knew I had found the bartender who was named Rocky in the play. Falk and Miner, who had replaced an actor in The Iceman Cometh after it opened, got to know each other. They were nearly the same age, and in 1958, Miner cast Falk in a production of The Bonds of Interest by Spanish Nobel winner Jacinto Benavente. It ran for 32 performances. Falk was very bright. When he and I talked, it was mostly about contemporary French theater, with him wanting to know which plays might be right for American actors. When I moved into the Mission, he was working on scenes with Albert Salmi, who had won early recognition when he played opposite Kim Stanley, a major star of the Actors Studio, in William Inge's Bus Stop on Broadway. One day, Falk came back to the apartment raging. "Can you believe it?" he stormed. "That effing Neanderthal is telling me how to read a line." I never saw Falk without his prosthetic eye, which he had received after surgery when he was 3. Before he lay down to sleep, he put it in a glass of water on the night table beside his bed. The Mission served mainly as a dormitory. During the day, we were frequently all out looking for jobs, attending rehearsals, going to tryouts, seeing matinees, or in the case of Falk and Rogers, shooting pool at the local billiard parlor. Leaving the building on the first floor, we passed the photo studio of Irving Claw, who would later become known for his top model Betty Page and his bondage films. When you came home at night, it was not unusual to find a drunk asleep in the stairwell. Only once did we have a party there, for about 20 friends, on New Year's Eve. The five of us rarely ate together, but almost every Saturday, Miner and I would shop for food for everybody in the ethnic stores on First Avenue. Olives scooped out of barrels of brine, chunks of cheese cut off giant wheels, big round loaves of Italian bread, quarters of freshly killed chicken. My favorite story of Mission life, best told by Carruthers, took place before I got there. The previous summer, most of them were working in regional theaters, and those who could had rented their rooms to people recommended by friends. When Miner returned one evening in late August, the apartment was empty. He showered, turned on a floor fan, put clean sheets on his bed, and stretched out to read. He soon became aware of little black dots moving around on the top sheet. So he slept in another bed. And the next day he doused the mattress with 2 cans of insect spray and hauled it up to the roof to air out. Shortly after that, Carruthers returned to find that the avocado plant he had started from a seed was almost dead. So he took it up to the roof to get some sun. The mattress was gone. A few days later, he went up to see how the plant was doing, and here Carruthers would pause. The mattress was back. Next photos, shapes of things to come. Jose Quintero outside the original circle in the square, 1957. Chiz Schultz, Philip Miner, and the author, Wayne Lawson, camp it up before attending a charity benefit in the late 50s. 2. More than ever before, New York then was Mecca for theater hopefuls. In 1959, 56 plays opened on Broadway, among them The Sound of Music, A Raisin in the Sun, and The Miracle Worker. Off-Broadway was also booming. In 1954, Joseph Papp had inaugurated Shakespeare in the Park, which provided hundreds of roles for actors and technicians, and in 1967, he would open the public theater in the old Astor Library on Lafayette Street, where he put on a dozen shows annually, including such superhits as Hair that year and A Chorus Line 8 years later. In 1965, the Vivian Beaumont Theater, part part of the newly created Lincoln Center, started up. It was an amazing period in New York's history. The time of the Kennedys, the Beats, the Beatles, Robert Moses, Betty Friedan, the feminine mystique, and Petula Clark, downtown. Of Vietnam War demonstrations, human rights marches, and women's lib. Pennsylvania Station was being torn down, and the Verrazano Narrows Bridge was going up. Everything seemed affordable in those days. Even the occasional dinner at Luchow's, the German restaurant a block from the Mission on 14th Street, with its small string orchestra, its gorgeous Christmas tree, and its banks of lilies at Easter time. For lunch, if you were broke, you could have the hot dog and orange drink at Nettick's, or insert 3 or 4 nickels to open a little glass door for a sandwich at the automat. 3 actors I knew lived in Coldwater flats with monthly rents of $20, roughly $220 today, or less. Almost everyone smoked, heavily. Cigarettes cost 26 cents a pack. A subway token was 15 cents. The most expensive ticket for Gypsy, the musical starring Ethel Merman, was $9.20. And if you paid $1.25 for a seat up in the family circle at the old Metropolitan Opera on 39th Street, you could hear some of the greatest voices of the century. Birgit Nilsson, Leontine Price, Renata Tabaldi, Richard Tucker, and Franco Corelli, to name a few. In much of the United States back then, homosexuality was still culturally taboo, if not outright illegal. But New York City was different. Though the Stonewall riots and the resulting gay pride movement would not happen until 1969, the humor known as camp was very much in the air. Expressions such as "he's a camp" and "camping it up" were common parlance, and many actors, both straight and gay, had a repertoire of jokes they told in a swishy, effeminate voice. Rogers and Minor were exceptionally good at it. Everyone seemed to have the same stack of LP records that went well with cocktails. Broadway cast albums, Lenny Bruce, Ruth Draper, Elaine May, and Mike Nichols. Campy recording artists such as Bee Lilly and Francis Fay were also extremely popular. And if you wanted to play really hilarious stuff for friends, you put on Florence Foster Jenkins' murdering opera arias, or Joe Stafford, also known as Darlene Edwards, singing love songs off-key, or The Super Saccharine Manhattan Tower by Gordon Jenkins. In 1968, the general acceptance of camp and the gay life would be borne out by the 2.5-year off-Broadway run and the subsequent film of Mark Crowley's The Boys in the Band. Next, photos, absurdly great. Playwright Edward Albee and actor Ben Piazza in a publicity still for the off-Broadway production of The American Dream, 1961. Albee wrote the one act for Piazza. 3. I soon got to know another actor who had worked with Quintero in Iceman, George Segal, who at 26 was by far the most driven of all the aspiring individuals in our circle of friends. He had worked as a janitor at Circle in the Square, just to be able to understudy the role of the young anarchist in the play, which he eventually played. He and I bonded when it came out that we had rented the same room on Rue de la Harpe in Paris. He was the Monsieur Georges the landlady was still raving about when I moved in. He and Marion, his sharp, attractive wife, were soon regulars in my social life. Segal played the banjo, and twice I went to hear him and his friend Patricia Scott, the ex-wife of George C. Scott, perform folk songs in a small club in the village. The Segals once invited a group of us to a cocktail party in an apartment they had borrowed from a relative. We arrived to find 2 chairs blocking the doorway to the dining room, where the inevitable spread of cold cuts, cheese, and crackers was carefully laid out. When we remarked on it, George explained that they wanted to keep everything nice until Jose arrived. He then got neckties from the lender's closet and hastily distributed them to all of us who weren't wearing one. That brings me back to Jose Quintero, whom it is impossible to overestimate as a changing force in American theater. I met him personally through Isabel Halliburton, his beautiful, witty secretary assistant, who would become one of my closest friends. Born in Panama, Quintero, with his penetrating dark eyes and soft, seductive voice, was an irresistible presence. At 35, he was already established as the most sought-after director in the city. Only 8 years earlier, with the producer Theodore Ted Mann, he had turned an abandoned nightclub at Sheridan Square into a small theater in the round, which they named Circle in the Square. Quintero's core idea was to revive plays by important playwrights that had flopped on Broadway, and he had an uncanny instinct for recognizing untapped talent. In 1952, he staged Tennessee Williams' Summer and Smoke and introduced Geraldine Page, a former fellow student at the Goodman School of Drama in Chicago, whose ongoing bad luck in New York had reduced her to working in a sewing factory. It was an unheard-of success for Off-Broadway. In 1956, he resurrected The Iceman Cometh and cast another unknown, Jason Robards Jr., in the lead role. 2 years later, he directed Children of Darkness by Edwin Justice Meyer, pairing Colleen Dewhurst and George C. Scott, who soon married and divorced twice. With Iceman, he struck gold. Though Eugene O'Neill had won the Nobel Prize and 4 Pulitzers, Iceman bombed so definitively on Broadway in 1946 that no work of his had been produced in New York since. After Quintero's triumphant revival of the play, O'Neill's widow offered him Long Day's Journey Into Night, a late work the playwright considered so agonizingly personal that he said it should not be performed in New York until 25 years after his death, which occurred in 1953. Just 3 years later, Carlotta O'Neill gave it to Quintero, so the first work he directed on Broadway happened to be the greatest play ever written by an American. He cast Friedrich March, Florence Eldridge, March's wife, Robards, and Bradford Dillman, and the critics outdid one another in their raves. By the time I got to know him, he was a celebrity, living in a penthouse on Lower Fifth Avenue. Relaxed over cocktails with friends, Quintero was a riveting storyteller. One night, he related, for instance, how in 1958, he had attempted to deal with the great Croatian soprano Zinka Milanov in Cavalleria Rusticana at the Metropolitan Opera. A large lady in her 50s, Milanov was accustomed to simply taking center stage and producing glorious sound. Hoping to enliven her performance, Quintero said he suggested that she should almost sneak on stage, not wanting to be noticed, because Santuzza has been abandoned by her lover and is ashamed. Instead, he said, when the rehearsal resumed, the diva walked straight to center stage and announced, "I am Zinka Milanov. I am not ashamed." Minor had a funny, revealing story about Quintero, the time he developed a crush on a young man he had cast. He asked Minor to find out if the actor was gay, and Minor asked why. "Because if he is, I'll kill him," Quintero responded, "and if he's not, I'll die." 4. The 60s brought significant changes for all of us, starting with the demise of the Mission. In 1960, Falk married his college sweetheart, Alice Mayo. Rogers married the actor Mitzi McWhorter, and both couples moved to Los Angeles. Falk, for his performance in Murder, Inc., released that year, was nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, as he was the following year for Pocketful of Miracles, starring Betty Davis. Rogers worked often in TV after moving to the coast, but it would not be until 1967 that he got serious attention for his part in Cool Hand Luke with Paul Newman. Early in 1960, I got a job as an encyclopedia editor at Grolier and moved into a five-room, fourth-floor apartment at 229 East 21st Street, rent $65. In short order, Miner and Carruthers got apartments at the same address, but by then I had moved two blocks away to 19th Street. Carruthers soon had a hugely talented partner, Jennifer Scanlon, a principal dancer in Jose Limon's company, and they had three miniature poodles, Fanny, Felix, and Emma. Meanwhile, friends had given me two Siamese cats, F. Jasmine and Stephen. So for years I would feed and walk their dogs when they were away, and they would feed my cats when I was. In 1961, Miner directed an off-Broadway revival of George Bernard Shaw's Miss Alliance, which got glowing reviews, played 156 performances, and allowed me to meet three actors he cast in it who were soon dear friends, Francis Sternhagen, Donald Moffat, and Wayne Tippett, who had the great good fortune in those days to be comfortably ensconced in a running role on a CBS soap opera, The Secret Storm. That year, Quintero directed a feature film, The Roman Spring of Mrs. Stone, based on a novel by Tennessee Williams, with Vivian Leigh, Warren Beatty, and Lottie Linya. That year, too, Ben Piazza opened off-Broadway in The American Dream, a one-act play written for him by Edward Albee, America's major exponent of the theater of the absurd, which explored man's meaningless existence, and which had begun in Europe after World War II, with the plays of Eugene Ionesco and Samuel Beckett. He and I stayed in touch, and when we got together, he would regale me with the latest happenings at the Actor's Studio. One day, he recounted Helen Hayes's recent visit. Lee Strasberg told the First Lady of the American Theater that unfortunately they were not doing scenes that day, just sense memory exercises. She said, fine. Then Shelley Winters got up and remembered giving a blowjob. When she finished, she threw back her head and cried, I'm not sucking any more effing C's. Strasberg, taking the situation in hand, Piazza said, first asked Winters to leave and not come back until she could be a lady, and then apologized to Hayes for the embarrassment. Piazza never discussed his relationship with Albee, but I assumed it was intimate, because the following year he played Nick in Albee's first full-length play, the very controversial Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And in 1964, he dedicated his only novel, The Exact and Very Strange Truth, to the playwright. Almost single-handedly, Albee took the American theater in a startling new direction, far from realism and method acting. By 1963, Quintero and Geraldine Page had become prominent members of the Actors Studio, and Quintero directed O'Neill's nine-act Strange Interlude, with a full studio cast, including Page in the lead, Jane Fonda, Betty Field, Ben Gazzara, and Franchot Tone. Though the play had won O'Neill a Pulitzer Prize in 1928, it no longer seemed daring, much less shocking, the way Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf did. In 1962, a cloud had fallen over the studio when its most famous member, Marilyn Monroe, died of an overdose at 36. To make matters worse, in 1964, Strasberg announced that he would direct his first studio production on Broadway, Chekhov's The Three Sisters, with Paige, Kim Stanley, and Shirley Knight as the sisters. Anticipation ran high at the thought of the god of method acting in America directing a work written for Stanislavski, the inventor of the method. Though it ran for 119 performances, and the critics were polite, the general consensus held that it was a bore. Everyone was soon quoting what Ilya Kazan, the studio's star director, had to say. When someone asked him what went wrong, it's Lee's favorite play, he reportedly responded, Lee can get it up, but he can't come. If Albee, who was 34 in 1962, changed Broadway for the foreseeable future with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Stephen Sondheim, who was 32, caused a comparable seismic shift in the American musical that year with a funny thing happened on the way to the forum. Though Sondheim was known as the lyricist of West Side Story and Gypsy, this was the first Broadway show for which he also wrote the music. In spite of some early skepticism on the part of the critics and audiences, and occasional dry periods, these two men would come to dominate their spheres of the American theater for the next 60 years. The books for two of Sondheim's musicals, Company, 1970, and Merrily We Roll Along, 1981, were written by George Firth, a friend of mine known most of his life as a character actor in films and on TV. He was also a master manipulator. Once, when I was on vacation in Los Angeles in the early 60s, he called me at my hotel to say he'd pick me up the next day, and we'd go to the beach. Soon after I got in Firth's car, we picked up another friend of his, who happened to be the wife of one of Jennifer Jones's sons, from her first marriage to Robert Walker. Before you could catch your breath, Firth had talked us into skipping the beach and going instead to the grand home of Jones and David Selznick to play croquet. Once there, he promptly asked Jones if she wouldn't please show me the famous portrait of Jenny featured in her film of that name, which she dutifully did. And so it went all that day, with Firth demonstrating once again his extraordinary knack for getting everyone around him to do what he wanted. Merrily We Roll Along was panned by the critics and closed after 16 performances. In its most recent sold-out revival, directed by Maria Friedman, it had a top ticket price of $750 and won 4 Tonys. 5. I went multiple times in 1964 to a wonderful off-Broadway production of Ben Jonson's The Alchemist, because by then I knew most of the actors in it, including Minor, Tippett, Madison Mason, the brother-in-law of a friend of mine, and Carol Macho, Tippett's wife, and I soon got to know two others, John Ed Heffernan and Roy Scheider, whose petite wife, Cynthia Babu, was also in the cast. Scheider, a late starter at 32, he had been in one horror film earlier that year, was slender and very good-looking. An amateur boxing champion in high school, he had served 3 years in the Air Force before seriously taking up acting. Like everyone else in the cast, he paid great deference to Heffernan, who played the lead. Heffernan was the most gifted actor I have ever known. At Boston University, his classmates had included Olympia Dukakis and John Cazale. In 1960, when he was 26, he won an Obie for his Justice Shallow in an off-Broadway production of Henry IV, Part 2. Earlier in the year, I met him. He had replaced Albert Finney in the title role in John Osborne's Luther on Broadway. And later that year, he would join John Gielgud and Irene Wirth in Albee's second Broadway play, Tiny Alice. He never stopped working, and his apartment was a gathering place for his friends and acolytes, including James Rado, one of the co-writers of Hair. Heffernan spent much of his free time watching old movies on TV, and he could enunciate precisely why a performance was good or bad. He once observed, for example, that Judy Garland was the only totally intuitive performer he could think of, incapable of making the slightest false gesture. I was hardly the judge of talent Heffernan was, so it never occurred to me that 4 of the actors I was now on very friendly terms with would become household names. I was surprised when Peter Falk was nominated so soon for 2 Oscars, and happy for him when he won an Emmy in 1962 for a guest appearance on The Dick Powell Show. But I never would have dreamed that as Columbo, a role first imagined by the producers for Thomas Mitchell, Scarlett's father in Gone with the Wind, or Bing Crosby, he would become a TV immortal, performing the part 69 times between 1968 and 2003. After starring in movies for the next 2 decades, directed by such big names as John Cassavetes and Elaine May, he became so famous that in 1987, the German director Wim Wenders cast him in every actor's ultimate dream role, playing himself, Peter Falk, the creator of Columbo, in Wings of Desire. In 1965, George Segal burst into stardom with Ship of Fools and King Rat. A year later, he achieved superstardom in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, playing the role Piazza had played on the stage, with Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, and Sandy Dennis, directed by Mike Nichols, all of whom, including Segal, were nominated for Academy Awards. Taylor and Dennis won. In 1967, he got great reviews playing Biff in a TV version of the American classic Death of a Salesman with Lee J. Cobb, the original Willie Loman. After starring in 1970 with Ruth Gordon in the outrageous comedy Where's Papa, he became a favorite romantic leading man, acting opposite some of Hollywood's biggest names, Barbara Streisand, Jane Fonda, Goldie Hawn, Jacqueline Bisset, Natalie Wood, and Glenda Jackson. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, Interval Selections by Mark Hoffman.